Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg with another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what they care about, what they grapple with, what they want people to say at their funeral, and everything in between. This week, we talk with Dana Tortorici, editor-in-chief of N+1 magazine. Now, it's my fundamental belief that you can be a huge fan of your industry and also critique it at the same time. So I found N+1 magazine refreshing in that it offers no humble bragging, no ass-kissing, and no clickbait, just dead-on, beautifully written social commentary. If you want to read something that may challenge core fundamental beliefs, pick up a copy of N+1 magazine. I'm such a believer that I feel something of a moral responsibility to encourage you to read it. In this podcast, Dana and I talk about women in tech, the lean-in philosophy of feminism, and the difference between an artist and a business person, and a lot more. All right, here's Dana.
What's your reading diet?
Well, I used to joke that I didn't read anything that wasn't an N+1 because I'm an editor, so I spend a lot of my day reading submissions and editing people's stuff, and it takes up a lot of time, like not just daytime, but my free time afterward. But what do I read? I almost exclusively get my feed of articles through Twitter. I didn't used to be a Twitter person. I did not get Twitter at all. And then at some point, I just got totally sucked in. You just start following enough people, and then it creates a tiny social world. It's a little scene on there. And it's so weird. You can be selective about being around certain people that you can't be around in life just because of not just oh, they're famous, I can't be around this person, but just people I would not meet in my daily life ever because they live in a different country or they're part of a different socioeconomic strata than me or whatever. So I read a lot of really random, weird stuff that I get from Twitter. Most of it is related to, I would say, what are my themes, my beats. A lot of stuff about feminism, a lot of stuff about, obviously, book publishing, media stuff. And then a lot of think pieces, a lot of essays that are trying to write about politics or do cultural critique that is pegged to a news item to try to make sense of it. Most of the time they're really bad because they're trying to do something that is best done slowly in a really quick turnover. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they're really great, the pieces that are just better written op-eds.
How do you feel about BuzzFeed and Vice?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me. I have so many feelings. So which one should I do first?
Whatever comes to mind.
Okay, I'll do BuzzFeed first. So BuzzFeed was just a maniacal quiz website that was just all over my Facebook. And then I remember my first friend to be hired by BuzzFeed to do long form was my friend Sandra. And I remember she told me she got the job originally to do something totally different and then was we're doing a long form vertical. And I was this is completely antithetical. Publishing long nonfiction pieces on BuzzFeed, the cat list GIF website. And then they just, I guess, got a lot of money, a lot of venture capital to hire an entire journalism investigative staff and a book staff. And now I have five or so really good friends who work there and who are doing really, really kick-ass work.
And do they feel conflicted or are they killing it?
I don't know if they feel conflicted. I'm sure they felt a little weird at first, but my friend Katie Baker, she's the one who's writing probably the best stories out there right now about the campus beat.
She was on the long form. That's the
She's amazing. Good. And she's a really good reporter. And, she's been doing the exact same kind of reporting, when she was at Jezebel and Newsweek before she went to BuzzFeed. But now, millions of people read her stuff. And for a journalist who just wants to, get her stuff out there, that's amazing for her. Yeah. And I'm just of course you want people to read this. And my friend David Noriega is also, doing a lot of investigative reporting. My friend Kat Stoffel just got hired to be the deputy ideas editor, and she's really brilliant. Another friend, Rachel, has been working there for a while. Sandra's been working there for a while. They're all super, super smart people. they also just like have so much money that they treat their employees really well. Like,
yeah,
they get paid like 3 times as much as I get paid. They have fucking dental insurance. Like, I do not have dental insurance. Right. They get like free froyo and shit. Yeah. And they seem really happy. And so I feel kind of conflicted about BuzzFeed for those reasons. I'm like, oh, it's a good, pretty good employer. Yeah. Like, they're not watering down the work. It's just surrounded by all this like weird crap I don't understand. And so I don't understand how they make any money and how they'll continue to make money. But we'll see. Time will tell. Oh, also, they have like a new podcast called Another Round that's really good with Tracy in Heaven. And it's really awesome. But I think one thing that's a little bit pernicious about BuzzFeed to me is that you can tell they don't think that like cultural politics and like politics are the same. So they're totally comfortable like honing in on like the LGBT community or the Black community or the Brown community and like giving voices to a lot of writers and editors who have been having a really hard time breaking into like white mainstream old man media. And the work that those people are doing is amazing. And so it's cool that, like, finally somebody's been giving these people the platform that, like, they deserve. But then I kind of worry, like, oh, like, what is BuzzFeed's politics? Like, is this politics as demographics? Like, it's very easy to, like, target you yeah. as a consumer if I'm putting out a bunch of identity posts about, like, you know you are yeah. X when. And, like, that's, like, the perfect marriage of demographic research and, like, pretty compelling content that's, like, has, you know, a political component that's not bullshit. And so I don't think it's, like, evil, but I do wonder.
It's so interesting because it's a merging of a few different things. And I think what's happening is, like, the people who understand advertisers and the people who understand growth hacking on the internet, like how social works and how to bring traffic to websites, is just a very different group of people than the people who can write great content.
Mm-hmm.
And they think about it from radically different lenses. And so it's just a very interesting model to start with where they started and then to hire all these amazing people. And then places like the New York Times, they'll call me and be like, what would you do if you were me? People who understand product and growth, they're starting to hire them in-house. And I wonder how these different groups of people can talk to each other or even address each other's existence.
Yeah, I mean, me too.
Have you written anything about Silicon Valley or, for better or worse, like Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen? Well, I happen to be a big fan. But some of these people are like the influencers of the next, like they're the most important people right now.
I know a lot of people who have written about it. A friend of mine, Sarah Leonard, she works at The Nation and she used to work at Dissent, you know, put together this really great issue of Dissent magazine. It must have been like a year, at least a year ago, about women in tech. And I also have sort of read a lot about the perception issues with like tech being male.
Yeah.
My friend Astra Taylor wrote a book called The People's Platform, and she's written about how like tech is marketed to men and like talked about as like something your dad can do. And the statistic that I hear all the time is that 50% of women leave tech. And it's not because they can't do it. It's because, like, it's incredibly unpleasant for them to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, like, been kind of interested in reading about Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah.
Because she is kind of, like, the great exception or
she
whatever.
She might be president someday.
I have mixed feelings about her, too, because I didn't read her whole book. And I'm, like, very sympathetic to a lot of people on the left who are kind of like, this is, like, white C-suite feminism. Like, this is feminism for a very, very particular kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
It's not accessible to most women in the United States. Like, it just does not speak to their experience at all. And it also, in this way, that makes a lot of sense in the tech sector, but doesn't maybe make sense in other businesses or in other fields, relies on the sort of resilience and resources and decision making of individual women. Basically, it's like Lean In as a book of hacks. You know, mm-hmm. It's like men are going to perceive you this way, so you can work with that by doing X.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, screw that. I would like to change the system whereby men perceive me this way. So I have to do X yeah. if I'm going to get Y. And I'm totally sympathetic to that. I'm like, word, yeah. I agree. But, you know, at the same time, my roommate was giving lessons to an older middle-aged woman who she was teaching her how to do Pro Tools or something. You know, she was doing like tutoring basically after hours. And the woman gave her Lean In, was like, I feel like this book would be really important for you. So we read it, and it was incredibly depressing because it paints a pretty bleak portrait of options for women in power. But it also had like a lot of really practical advice that like I wouldn't want to deny anybody based on the critique that like Sheryl Sandberg is like an imperfect liberal white feminist. Like, yeah, you should ask for a raise. Like, you should do that. Like, it's good to know what's not going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do other mainstream kind of, and not to get too on this beat, but like Lena Dunham or Beyonce, do they frustrate you similarly for different reasons?
No, not really. I mean, like, I think that they're artists. And I have different expectations of artists.
That's really interesting.
I think that their activism is part of their personality and what they do, and part of their creative expression too. In Beyonce's case, like, she wants to like put up a big sign that says feminist on stage. Like, fuck yeah, I'm down with that. To like make that a normal, not scary word for like everybody who listens to Beyonce. But like, who am I to be like, you're not good as a feminist icon? Like, I kind of don't believe that it's their responsibility to be role models.
Whereas like Sandberg does, because she's a businesswoman?
Because Sandberg does is not because she's a businesswoman, but because she co-opted some strategies from the feminist movement for Lean in this way that was specifically interpolating, specifically like referring to herself as like the leader of a social movement. You know, like, I always wanted to lead a social movement, that sentence that she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Her like circle groups, whatever she called them, Lean In circles, that's a direct rip off of consciousness raising groups from the American radical feminists of the 1970s and like the women's and the civil rights movement. And so if you're going to co-opt that for commerce and you're basically going to say like, I am interested in being a leader of a social movement, then you are you're accountable on the terms that you've set out for yourself.
Is Jay-Z an artist or is he a business person? Like, I don't even call them artists.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think Beyonce's an artist. I think Jay-Z
the business is their art.
Right. And I think that's even increasingly common, like, in the art world, like the sort of New York fine art world. And, you know, it's old. Like, Andy Warhol did this. You know, he's, like, the most interesting artist, like, running a business or something. Because there are so many weird relationships in business that are, you know, fascinating, and you want to mine them theoretically, and artists are interested in doing that. But yeah, I don't think that like being an investor is being an artist. But it's also like you're allowed to be more than one thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Are you familiar with Rap Genius?
I am familiar with Genius.
Are you familiar with what happened with the founders and the story? And
I'm not really that familiar with the whole backstory on Genius.
This one founder, Mahbub, who's a personal friend, he calls himself an artist, and he annotated the text, the Elliot Rodgers Manifesto, and he was like, this is beautifully written, is one thing he said. And two, he said something around the lines like, I bet his sister was hot, in response to one of his.
Oh, please. That's such a lame thing to write.
Certainly that. And then he also wrote this piece, which infuriated Silicon Valley, of how to steal from Whole Foods. And it was like a very detailed account of how he would steal. And it was kind of well written, and it was kind of funny. But if you like him or not, I think it's just very interesting how a lot of people in business and tech would like reference hip hop artists or pop artists in blog posts. And sometimes these people say like pretty terrible things. But this person's an artist, they can say whatever they want. This person's a business person, they like can't be a real person. That's what it means, really. They can't have any opinions. They can't do anything that's controversial because the capital is representative of people who invested in them.
Mm-hmm.
And to simplify, you know, Rick Ross talks about, you know, roofies, and Mahbub talks about how to steal from Whole Foods, and he's like blackballed.
Well, I think the fact that there's a couple of things going on here. Like, one is like, are you doing something in the context of an artwork? Is the first question. And like, how good is the art? And then like, what are the stakes of the art? Like, I don't think that art that's like really antagonistic and has no personal stakes is very interesting. That just looks like trying to have it all, just like doing a power grab where, like, you know, here you're a guy who runs a very valuable company and you're talking about stealing from Whole Foods. Like, you're just trying to rub it in that you're really rich. Like, well, that's not that funny. Like, that's just actually not that funny. And I also don't really think that's art, you know? Maybe that's snobby, but I think it's true. And I think that that's, you know, like, if you're going to be a young guy who's going to make a ton of money in tech and, like, be the founder of a business for which you have to be a figurehead and, like, be tactful about when and where you say things, like, I'm sorry, that's the bargain you made, yeah. Dude. Like, nobody else is getting buckets of free money. Like, the least you could do is, like, be decent and have some discretion.
It's interesting, that one, because it implies that there's, like, some sort of spite. People don't understand how these people make money. It's, like, assumed that it's kind of luck, mm-hmm. or that they don't deserve it, mm-hmm. or that it's just, it's hard to understand.
Well, I think it's a lot of, it's the similar contempt that people feel for finance capital, where a lot of the money is fictitious.
But those guys are dicks.
Yeah, and people in tech sure are not dicks ever. Definitely, they're never dicks.
I think it is a big difference. But, I mean, what do I know? But
this is the thing. If you're going to, like, divide the sort of social world into, like, click tables in high school, yeah. Jockey eye bankers are a different kind of bully than, like, the tech nerds.
Yeah.
But y'all are both still bullies. And, like, that's the thing that people in tech kind of don't always get, is, like, you still have a lot of power, and, like, whoever you're comparing yourself to, like you don't want to be, like, comparing yourself to finance, being like, well, we're right. better than yeah. American finance. But that's just an aside. The thing about the fictitious capital is, like, yeah, of course people don't get that. I don't even get that. I'm like, what does this value represent? It's just an investment on potential for what this thing might do later. And it's unclear what value it's contributing to society yet. And, like, in a country where people have, like, so much student debt and, like, so many housing problems,
yeah.
and, like, there's, like, growing economic inequality every day, yeah, it's hard to, like, give those guys a break, you know?
Right.
They're winning.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It's ridiculous, but from our side of the things, we think that everything we say, there's, like, gossip journalists, like, waiting to, like, attack, and you just can't, like, make any jokes anymore.
Right. Well, I guess I would say two things. One is, like, get a better sense of humor, maybe. And two is, if there are, like, paparazzi in your house, like, then I don't know what to tell you. But I think annotating the, for the record, totally not well-written journals of a misogynist mass murderer is, like, the privacy of your own home. If you think that's, like, a private expression or joke, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You built this platform to reach millions and millions of people. Like, you should be the first person to know that that's how many people you're going to reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's done a lot of stuff. But I think it's just interesting how things like Genius or BuzzFeed get big, they get a lot of money, and then they kind of determine, like, the values of their respective, like, worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is changing so quickly that a lot of things are being disrupted, air quotes.
Oh, man, this is, like, a tangent.
Go for it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have a really good idea that for something you should disrupt.
Yeah.
You guys should disrupt private childcare.
Tell us about it.
To break it down really simply, the fact that people have kids, men and women, and need to stick them somewhere when they're at work, it's a universal basic need.
Yeah.
Everybody needs it because everyone knows that time is, like, value. And it's insane that there are not any state public services that are really sufficient to the demand of childcare. And, you know, everything in the United States is privatized. So you have privatized healthcare, privatized, you know, whatever, you know, university. I think that there should be, like, a, like, tech-facilitated way for people to crowdsource childcare. And I think that the only reason it hasn't been made yet is because there's not enough women in tech to
right.
be like, here's a really obvious thing that can be disrupted. So there's, like, a free, like, $1 billion idea.
Yeah, if someone takes it, you should be an advisor.
I would
should give you
please
some,
let me advise
some basis
you.
Basis points. Do you have strong thoughts on Uber?
I have thoughts. I don't know if they're really strong.
This idea of, like, a servant economy is really interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that, like, there are taxi drivers before there was Uber. So
yeah.
I think that, like, the problem is not that, like, there are people driving other people around. I mean, whatever. That's a different story. I think that, like, the fact that, like, those jobs are not secure is really bad. Like, you can't unionize Uber. Or maybe you can. But, you know, that, like, those jobs at Lyft and Uber are not super secure.
No, yeah.
Is a total problem. But I gotta say, like, you know, I have friends who, you know, Black women say, like, it's really hard for me to hail a cab. Uber has to pick me up.
Yeah.
Like, so people who shit on Uber, like, I'm sorry, like, I'm a woman of color, like,
yeah.
like leaving a party late at night, like, I know I can get a car, like, that's a huge win for me.
Mm.
And it's totally convenient. So I think, you know, there are two sides to it. I think it's damaging to a lot of people, but I think it's kind of opened up some interesting conversation.
And people can work their own hours. And people in San Francisco, some make like $100,000 a year driving an Uber.
Well, that's the thing. I guess the debate, right, is between the people who are like the quote unquote weekend warriors who are just like doing it to make some extra money. And then people who are like, I like am a cab driver as my living and this is screwing me over. I think that the kind of increasing tendency in the labor force to make things like flexible and temp and part time as a way to screw people out of like security and benefits is a big problem. But, you know, the fact that people say flexibility instead of precariousness is because flexibility is helpful and good for a lot of people. I just wish that flexibility and security did not have to be mutually exclusive the way that they seem to be right now.
Yeah. You mentioned in the long form podcast that your dad was in TV
and
was really focused on how to make things that everyone loves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the ethos of tech.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when we talk about making something meaningful in tech, meaningful is directly equal to how many people can see it. Like, it's not just some side project. Like, it's meaningful, which is a really interesting way of looking at it. But N plus One has been, you know, a niche thing since, like, its inception. From a very early age, did you think about, like, I don't care if everyone sees it as long as, like, a few people see it and like it?
I mean, you know, it wasn't, like, a conscious, like, I reject my father's path or anything like that. I didn't get the same thrill out of thinking about reaching millions and millions of people. You know, I'm kind of a private person and like, you know, I like books, you know, I'm kind of a nerd. And so I always loved literature. I studied English in college and I knew that I wanted to, I'm not one of those people who like always wanted to be a writer or anything. I've always loved writing. I've always loved editing, but I knew that I wanted to work with words and be a reader. Like I wanted to be able to read all the time. Like that's the best thing for me. It's so pleasurable and so interesting and stimulates like a lot of important parts of like who I see myself as, like how who I am. And I think that print is not the, you know, mass technology that it once was, but that's not like why I got into print. I didn't get into print because it was, or even like literature, cultural criticism, the stuff N plus One does. I didn't like get into it because it was small and I was like, oh, phew, no one will pay attention to me over here. It was what I like to do. But I'm not one of those people who's like, got to be where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I might be one of those people. Have you read Franzen's Doomsday stuff about like how no one's reading books anymore?
I try to not read Franzen on the internet. I just don't, you know, he doesn't spend enough time there to like speak as eloquently about it as some other writers can.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's an amazing writer, but I don't think that's like his most valuable contribution to the culture.
Do you think it's a good time for books? And are you like excited about the future? Is that like a silly thing to even have an opinion on?
I don't know. You know, I'm also like not one of those people who's like really attached to the book form. It's true that I am like part of a generation that still grew up reading physical books and finds reading physical books the easiest way to process information at book length. And, you know, my little cousins who are growing up, like, you know, putting iPads in their mouth when they're two, like, they're probably going to find it much easier to read things on a screen. And so, like, whatever. So it goes. Like, I was never, like, deeply attached to the paper. Of course, like, I loved the smell of books and all those things people fetishize, but, like, that's because I loved reading, and I associated those smells with reading, not because I was like, glue. Binding glue smells so amazing. So, I mean, the future of the book stuff isn't tremendously important to me. It's, like, not the thing I think about. I think more about what shapes the literature and the sort of support networks that fund writers, fund editors. I think that, you know, what you're doing, which is, you know, basically a curation service, is kind of the natural reaction to the sort of spillover of like massive communication with the web. And you see a similar thing with, you know, digital publishing is you have tons of writers. And I think that there's a real shortage of really talented editors. And that's where a lot of the value is like people who not only know how to identify talent, but like are patient enough to work with people to bring things to a level of excellence and to really stay the course and have independent criteria for what makes excellent and meaningful writing that's not just page views, you know?
Right.
So I think that's kind of what I think about. And I don't see it as a war, you know? I'm not like, it's you versus me, because like I'd lose, duh. So it's not helpful for me to think about it that way. But, you know, I've never been like one of those people who's like likes to gamble or is like wildly predictive. Like, it's just not part of my personality. And so I have like, I don't have speculations on like what the future is going to be like. And like, I also know that like I've chosen a way of being in life that I'm like not going to be one of those people that really determines like what the world looks like in terms of like technology, you know, like shaping the material conditions. Like the way I would do that if I would do it at all is going to be socially and culturally. It's not going to be, you know, technological or economic. That's a kind of defeatist thing to admit, like as an individual person. Like I have political beliefs and like I believe like that people can collectively demand things and say like, hello, we're destroying the planet. This is a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Like, let's not do that. But so we could be like, think about how much longer you could make money if you didn't destroy the planet. You could make money for like another 100 million years. Doesn't that sound great to you guys? What I mean to say is that like, you know, I'm going to live in the world that for better or worse, these people you guys are making for us. You people are making for us. And you know, I'm gonna react in a way to hopefully keep it. So, you know, you have a lot of responsibility. You can't be like making like lame-o teenager rape jokes when you're like, you know, master of the universe.
Yeah. It's interesting because what I'm getting from is our worlds are like essentially not interacting with each other at all. And I think it's going to change soon because it will be unescapable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are and they aren't. Like, I think, you know, I take the train to work and everybody on the train has a fucking smartphone. And that just like changes the way that people hold their bodies, you know, it changes people's posture. It's going to change their medical conditions. Like, it changes the way people communicate with one another, like really, really basic stuff. So like that's obviously already pervasive. But I think that like what's actually different is that people in tech are living in a totally different temporal frame than people who are working in publishing or people who are just working in the sort of like mainstream American workforce. And, you know, it's very futurist oriented from where I'm sitting, like what's going on in Silicon Valley. Partly it's ideological. There's like, we know, well, what can the future be? There's this idea like that it can be shaped in some way. But it's also from like an investment perspective. And in that way, it's like finance too. It's like it's futures, you know, like it's not the same. It's not like we're not in the same world. We're just like not in the same time frame.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you talk about the social and cultural things that you wanted, and please be as explicit as you can, what does that mean, or like what questions do you grapple with, or what like thing, how do you like see yourself?
I don't know, hard to say, but I think feminism is like one of my causes
to bear.
I mean, it's not a terrible cross to bear, but because it's just who I am, you know, like I was born a woman with a lot of pride and talent and humor and convictions and like a real desire to, you know, like live in a grand manner and succeed at the things that I did. And as a privileged person, especially who like expected things of the world for myself, which is like, you know, totally privileged thing, I would be mad that like boys would get things that I didn't get and for no apparent reason whatsoever. That each generation kind of finds it harder and harder to convince their children of. Like, their kids are like, wait, why is this like, why can't I wear shorts? And their parents are like, well, I guess you can wear shorts. You don't have to wear a skirt. Like, I guess that's a pretty good reason. You know, I think that these are getting laxer and laxer with each generation. And, you know, sexism has really affected my life. And I don't think it needs to. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me as, like, one of the most obvious attainable improvements to life is improving the social equality between women and men. And obviously it's very complicated because it's also like specific to different cultures. It's different in different countries and different subcultures and everything. But especially when it comes to, like I was saying, like the most basic elements of life, which is like sustenance, like the ability to pursue pleasure and like feel secure and be able to support yourself and all that stuff. And so I think that, you know, that's what I focus a lot of in my editing and my writing, and also the people I try to bring into the magazine. And, you know, I know that's limited because I just like can't be a politician. Like I would just suck so much at it.
Because you're a real person.
Yeah. Because I want to be a real person. And apparently you're like not allowed to do that and like be a politician at the same time.
Well, same thing with business, and that's what we're really worried about.
Right. Well, I mean,
or a famous business person.
Right. Do you guys have publicists?
Yeah, we do.
Good. I was gonna say you guys should get those if you don't have them. But yeah, I would also just like encourage more people in tech to like read more like critical theory.
Yeah.
Because it's like really good and really interesting, and like to just challenge your worldview. Like, it's going to make you so much more inventive. And if you want to know what people want, you have to know how they live and like what their experience of the world is. And so, yeah, like women, it's like pretty much like more than half the population seems like a pretty good target demographic. A lot of people who are going to want that universal childcare. I'm just telling you.
So that's the idea. Who are some authors off top that people that we should be reading?
Well, okay. I feel like I can't like recommend my favorite things because it's just like I want to like keep it simple. But I think like
besides N plus one, of course.
Well, I mean, obviously, right? N plus one. You should read Emily Witt's amazing article from N plus one about the kink castle, kink.com. It's just like a really interesting and like graphic and incredibly well-written article about like hardcore like BDSM porn in San Francisco in the sort of new era of San Francisco as like a fair kind of tech-friendly Google colonized place. It's really good. It's called What Do You Desire? It's really good. Read that. And then, you know, I like Amanda Hess's writing. She writes for the Slate Double X column, and she, I think, has covered... She wrote a piece that I think won a National Magazine Award about women being bullied on the internet. And I don't know. I mean, just, like, approach it with some... I'm making prayer hands right now. Like, approach it with some sympathy because, like... Yeah, just like the shit women have to put up with for just like deciding to participate in life in any way, to go outside, to like, you know, to just like be online the same way you're going to be online, like just cut them a break. And I think that her stuff is really good and it's also very accessible. And then if you want some really awesome shit, you should read Virginie Despentes. She wrote a really good book called King Kong Theory. That's really, really good.
Awesome. And the conversation we just had, like, no one has this at all. Like, no one looks at it through these lenses. Like, everyone's just so busy, like, learning.
Yeah, and, like, that's cool. Like, everybody's busy, but, like, that's why you gotta have more women in there, because they're just gonna, like, it'll be hard for you for, like, maybe 6 months, because you're used to, like, being with people you're really comfortable with. You can focus on what it is that you're making because there's no social friction. But like, I think that the industry as a whole is at a place where it can stand to be disrupted itself. And you're just going to make better products if you account for the desires and needs and like reality of an enormous population of people who feel shut out right now and are shut out.
Perfect.